And good evening and welcome to Bird Calls, made possible tonight by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. We invite you to call in with your questions tonight about our feathered friends and the avian world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he's ready to answer your questions about birds tonight. Cliff is currently the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he has held since 1997, and he's been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He is the first author of the book Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M Press, and he has authored over 70 publications on birds and birding. He and his wife Julie and their two children live in East Texas. And Cliff, thanks for coming back again, to driving all the way up here from Nacogdoches.
Well, I'm happy to be here, and I'm happy to say this is our first episode as we now go monthly. How about that?
That's right. Bird Calls will now be on the second Tuesday of every month, so you can go ahead and plan out your calendar and join us every month with your questions about the avian world. We'd be happy to have you call in at 800-552-8502. So what's new in the birding world down in the Texas area?
Well, I think that the hurricane is on everybody's mind. Hurricane Harvey and what it did, dumping just buckets and buckets of rain on giant swath of Texas. That's got to be on everybody's mind. It's difficult to think about the wildlife issues when there's still a lot of people that haven't been recovering. You know, they're in the business of recovering and drying out and, you know, completely starting over. But hopefully we'll talk a little bit more about hurricanes later on.
Well, it certainly has probably recharged any wetlands that had not been recharged yet. However, I don't believe that was a problem this year. 2011, that might have been a different issue.
Yeah, and recharge times 5, times 10. I mean, they're even talking now about the weight of the water has push the elevation down by a few centimeters.
Wow.
Which is impressive to think about.
Yeah.
So we're in the middle of fall migration. I've noticed a lot of ruby-throated hummingbirds out in my backyard and our feeder, and that's not unusual. This is just on schedule. This is what we see in September, and it gets even better in the next week or two. So people should keep their hummingbird feeders up and running. Make sure you replace the nectar every few days, every 3 or 4 days, even if the birds don't drink at all. But I think most people will find that the hummingbirds will drain it. And probably 95-99% of the hummingbirds in this listening area are going to be ruby-throated hummingbirds. But there's an occasional oddball, and if you do have an oddball, take a picture and let us hear from you. If you have a rufous hummingbird, for example, that's the one that looks like a newly minted shiny copper penny in the mail. So they do show up in the listening area on occasion. But for the most part, they're almost all ruby-throated hummingbirds. If you see one that doesn't have a red throat, guess what? That's the female or the young of the year, the immature. So it's only the adult male that has the ruby throat.
Well, now, last month you left us with a conservation tip, and we always open the program with a little recap of that. Could you fill us in again and remind us what the conservation tip was last month?
Last month we talked about letting sawtimber-sized trees live. And what do we mean by sawtimber-sized trees? We're talking about the oldest, the biggest trees in the forest, and making sure that we have some of that. There are a lot of species of wildlife that require what we call old growth forests. Even though the forest might not all be old growth, if there are some signs of old growth in there, you know, one or two giant trees on the property, that can be really beneficial to wildlife. So you have to think about a forest like a community of humans with a varied age class, from toddlers, the little trees, to senior citizens, these sawtimber trees we're talking about. and you don't want to discriminate. We want to respect the senior citizens, so leave saw timber trees when you can on your property.
There you go.
Good for birds.
And you are listening to Bird Calls, and we've got phone lines open now at 800-552-8502, and we've got three calls on hold already, so right out of the gate, that's
wow.
Very good. So we're going to go first to Chris from Broadmoor right here in Shreveport. Chris, you're online with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
Hey, good evening, y'all. I've got a recording I can play you of a bird that goes all night long, it seems, for about the past month or so outside our home. It does a really loud series of chirps.
Okay.
Really resonant, and I don't know that this recording is going to do it justice. You'll hear it perhaps six times and tell me if that's enough. Hopefully,
yep.
We can hear it, okay?
Okay.
All right, I'll try.
Go. I already knew what it was before he played it, so...
good enough.
Yep. Yeah, that's not a bird.
That's a frog, isn't it?
It's a frog, and we've covered that one before in the past. It's called the Rio Grande chirping frog. Chirping because it does sound bird-like, and it does call all night, and they'll be in neighborhoods. I've got them outside my window. Here's the recording we played.
Yep, that's it.
Yep.
How about that?
And we covered that one,
about 4 months ago, five months ago.
I think even longer than that. I'm trying to look through my notes.
It's all a blur.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah, but
sorry to make you repeat.
No, it's good to repeat and refresh. So I'm glad you called about that because they have been calling loudly outside my bedroom window, and I've had to learn how to sleep with it because I don't mind a sound that's constant like the katydids. That's the big insect in the hot part of the summer that makes the ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch. It's very rhythmic, and I can sleep through that. But the chirping frog that you called about is sporadic. It's not rhythmic. And so I've had to learn to just focus on other noises or not no noise, because if you focus on this irregularity, you just lay there going, is it done for the night? Is he stopped? Oh, no, here he is again. He's calling again. And I end up staying up for hours listening to the chirping frog. But yeah, it's this last week has been amazing. We've had our windows open at night because it's so cool. It feels like fall. Hey, it is fall. And that's the Rio Grande chirping frog. It's not a bird. It sounds like a bird. The name even implies that with the word chirping in Rio Grande chirping frog. And but we do appreciate refreshers because I think it's been a long time since we talked about the chirping frog. So thanks for the call about the chirping frog. And Bill, we skipped over our profiled species.
Yeah, we didn't even get a chance to get to that. So we're gonna go ahead with that. Did you have another question there, Chris?
Well, will it stay? Is now? Do you assume it's here now that it's come? It's going to stay?
Yeah, these are not necessarily native to our area. They're not native to our area. They move around in shipping containers and potted plants, and the nursery industry. So this is a species. If you were here 60 years ago, 50 years ago, 40 years ago, you didn't hear it because they weren't here yet. So it's a new species that's here. And to answer your question, I think they're here to stay. They like sitting on a plant right outside in your flower beds. They'll be a few inches off the ground. They're itty bitty. Your smallest pinky fingernail might be bigger than this frog. So if you think you're going to go out and find it, and a lot of people, you know, they hear that and they get a flashlight and they go, let's go look for the bird. And they don't see anything, and it stops calling. As soon as they turn the light off, walk away, it chirps again, they go back. But if you now focus on looking for a frog, you're still going to have a heck of a time finding him. They're so little and so well hidden and tiny.
But a huge sound.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, big sound.
Thank you all very, very much.
Hey, thanks,
right,
Chris.
Thank you, Chris. Jake, and we have another caller online. We're going to put you on hold for just a second because we did. We skipped over our spotlight bird this month. And Cliff, what do you got for us this month?
Well, we're going to talk about the red-tailed hawk. It's the most common and widespread hawk in the U.S. It has a hoarse scream as heard here.
Sounds almost angry there.
And you can hear that hoarseness That's the scream of the red-tailed hawk. And so this is a bird of more open country, especially during the colder months along highways. And speaking of highways, if you drive on I-20 from Shreveport to Dallas on a cold winter day, you'll see several red-tails perched up on posts or wires as they watch for rodents scurrying in the grass below. Adult red-tails have a 4-foot wingspan that are broad-shaped for soaring. Males average slightly smaller than females, but there is some overlap, and they weigh about 3 pounds. We have a photo of a immature red-tailed hawk on our Red River Radio Bird Calls page, photo snapped by James Childress, so go ahead and look at that when you can. This species is polytypic, with at least 13 accepted races that involve huge variation in plumage. So polytypic means has lots of different looks. Most red tails have distinctive dark streaks across their pale undersides, something we often refer to as a dark belly band. And almost all red tails have dark backs, and most of them these birds in our Red River listening area have few pale and irregular smudges on their back that are very noticeable because they contrast on that dark back. It takes red tails 2 years to get the full orangey red tail. It's really orangey more than anything. It's almost a terracotta color. But it takes them 2 years to get that. Red tails eat rodents, rabbits, and other similarly sized mammals. They build large stick nests that can be reused for years and years. They typically lay 2 or 3 eggs, which take about 30 days to incubate. The youngsters fledge about 45 days after hatching, but after fledging, the young still depend on their parents for another month or two. It takes a while to figure out how to be a hawk.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We go now to Jake from Via Platte. Jake, you're online with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
We have a bunch of hummingbirds around, and I'm curious about where they go at night. I know they go into a state of torpor, and I go out looking for owls. I've often tried to find the hummingbirds, but never see them.
Well,
is there a certain type of tree or certain location in a tree that maybe they prefer?
So finding one's difficult because they're little. And they're not going to flock together and sit, you know, shoulder to shoulder. They can be anywhere, low in a shrub or high in a tree, where they have protection. And our hummingbirds don't go into a state of torpor. That is really reserved for a different climate. When you go into torpor, it's very cold outside, and that's to slow everything down, slow your metabolic rate, your breathing, your heart rate, everything slows down to save energy, but they don't do that here. So they're roosting, but they're roosting singly in the trees and the bushes, and good luck finding them because they're tiny. I mean, they're smaller, you know, than a tater tot, or maybe 2 tater tots, but that's really tough to find. And then think about how they're green and pale gray and white, and that can really hide in the trees and the shrubs as well. So I think you're going to have a tough time finding a roosting hummingbird. If you're lucky, maybe you're watching one feeding right near dusk and watch where they go. And then you can maybe find it. But I don't think I'd want to disturb a sleeping hummingbird. They need all the rest they can get.
I wasn't looking to disturb them. Yeah. I would just like to see them. I'm surprised to hear you say they don't go into torpor. Like, I thought at their average, like, metabolism, they would have to eat constantly through the night.
Yeah,
they didn't.
No, torpor drops their metabolism by a whole lot, and that is reserved again for cold climate. So hummingbirds up at 13,000 feet or higher in the Andes in South America, they'll go into a state of torpor. The bird really the most noticeable bird here in North America that goes into a state of torpidity is the common porwill, which is a nightjar out west,
right.
and that is in, you know, very cold nights when it does that. And so much that you could, if you find one, you're walking along a path at night with a flashlight, if you happen to find one, you'd be able to pick it up, and you'd think it was dead. It doesn't resurrect, so to speak, very quickly. It's just in this state of reserving all the energy it can. So the common poor will is our best example, and our ruby-throated is not a good example.
Huh, interesting. Yeah. I appreciate your information. Yeah.
Thanks, Jake.
All right. Thank you, Jake, for calling in. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We have three calls online. We're going to go to unknown caller here in just a moment. And Mary and Robert, please hang on. The line will be with you in just a moment. Okay, you're up next. I don't have your name, but you're on with Cliff Shackelford. What's your question?
This is Paul.
Hi, Paul. How are you?
Well, let me share two things. I had a blessed evening yesterday on Caddo Lake, in a very serene location called Pine Island Pond, and it's just what it sounds, probably 5 or 6 acres surrounded with cypress trees. And I typically see the small white egrets come in to roost.
Uh-huh.
And yesterday evening, I witnessed, 40, 50, 60, what looked like small cranes. And I looked it up earlier today, and I think it's a greater egret. Does that sound correct? And why are they on Caddo Lake grouping this time of year?
Yeah, those are all over the South. Those are, we often incorrectly call them rookeries. They're communal roosts, and a lot of these wading birds will get together at night. They also get together in the breeding season, and people that go fishing often see these big congregations of egrets and herons and allies nesting together. But what you witnessed is a roost site, and they'll do this roosting communally. There's safety in numbers when you roost together. And so it can be a lot of cattle egrets. That's probably the small white egret you saw. And
right.
And then the great egret is certainly possible in there. You'll also have little blue herons. You could have wood storks. That's one that gets people really excited this time of the year. And another one that will be around this time of the year is a very pink bird people call flamingo, which is the roseate spoonbill. And those birds are coastal nesters, but they'll move inland during the warmer months and into the fall. And we can see those at these communal roosts. So watch out for other neat birds coming in. I've seen at some of these heronries, and in the fall, I've seen blue-winged teal that are coming in to roost. I've seen early greater white-fronted goose come in, white-faced ibis. I mean, it's like Grand Central Station. It's really cool to see. So that site you found, they're going to use it over and over. So I would encourage you to, you know, keep your distance and maybe take binoculars and notes and see what all you see coming in there.
Get some good photographs and send them in to us as well.
Yep.
Well, I could do that. This is a spot that's not far from our home there, so I've been there a lot. It's just the first time I've seen that particular bird. Now, on Big Lake, almost to the Louisiana line, we were out, I think, late last January or early February, and saw pelicans by the hundreds out on the open water.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing to see something like that in East Texas.
Yeah, and that's a stopover site. I mean, we do have some that will stay in small numbers through the winter, but the big numbers are migrants that are stopping off and refueling just like we do at a convenience mm-hmm. store or gas station.
Okay.
Yeah, so.
Just a quick shout out for the GCLA, Greater Caddo Lake Association. Are you familiar with the Weevil program?
Absolutely. And I mean, I feel for anybody that's got giant salvinia problems because it's a cancer of our waters.
Yes, sir. And we've had a fantastic year because they made it over the winter and they cleared. They really done their job, and so the volunteers down there. So a shout out done, sir. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Paul.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We're going to go next to Mary from Shreveport. Mary, you're online with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
Hi. We've had just a bird call mystery at our house, and I'm hoping that you'll be able to solve that for us.
Okay.
There's a bird that you hear just outside in the mornings generally, and it sounds like it's saying, "We need you, we need you."
Yep.
And we have just, we've Googled it, and all we find is other people asking the same question, you know, "We need you. What bird is it?"
That's,
and so we have not been able to find the answer.
Yeah.
That. I know you can tell
and,
me.
And I think that the translation, putting a bird song to name, to words rather, can vary depending on the person. But I would guess that that's the Carolina Wren. And actually, Bill, we've profiled that one. Can you pull that up? And you
that's
know
it.
That's yep. How about that? That was easy. So yeah, I hear those outside my window, and some people say it sounds like tea kettle, tea kettle, and someone else told me that no, it sounds like cheeseburger, cheeseburger, cheeseburger. And so it just
Saturday
depends
Night
on
Live
the
fans.
Yeah, it depends on who's doing the translating. What was yours again?
We need you.
We need you.
Yep, I'm gonna write that down. That's a good one. So that's a new one for me. We need you, we need you. Okay, excellent. So that's Carolina Wren. A lot of people think they're house wrens because, oh, it's a wren, and there's my house wren. No, that's not how that's not how this works. So this is the Carolina Wren. They're very vocal. We have one that sings outside our house every morning as well, and it amplifies under our patio that's covered, and he just gets a lot more amplification doing it under the patio. So it's super loud. And if we have the window, back door open and we're sitting having breakfast, we're all laughing because it's just so loud. And I'm going to remember your phrase, "We need you, we need you." That's a good one. So thanks, Mary.
Thank you.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We have lines open now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question concerning our avian world is welcome, or things you hear at night you think are birds, or cries in the middle of the day that you're not quite sure
That's
about
right.
as well. Since we've covered red frogs and or red foxes and frogs and
gray squirrel, there's a lot of sound alikes, and we've covered that. And this might be a good time to mention that every episode of Bird Calls has a podcast at the Red River Radio website. And this, I think, according to my notes, is our 25th episode. Mm-hmm. So you have a lot of listening to do if you want to catch up to the show. And educational along the way. You'll hear a lot about birds, but we do mention these sound-alikes. But I do like the refreshers. I do like that. That Chris called early about the chirping frog because, yeah, it has been a while, and we constantly need refreshers. So,
well, give us a call now. Again, the number is 800-552-8502, and we're going to go to next to Robert. Robert, you're online. What's your question?
I wanted to learn something about roadrunners in the piney woods.
Oh.
I work in an office on the outskirts of Jasper, and we've had one coming to visit to pick the lizards off the outside of the building.
Well, they are a low density species. I would bet that roadrunners were not here 150 years ago. So they're a new addition to our area in the last half century.
And we actually had an online question about that from Theron Majors, who asked, "I see roadrunners in the Kissahatchee Hills regularly, but only in the hottest days of the year. Where does this bird go if it's not too hot, or if it's too hot? Does it migrate?" The person just didn't really know.
Kissahatchee Hills, yeah.
Kissahatchee?
Yeah, and same thing. Even when you go across the Sabine River into Louisiana, this is a bird of the West, the desert Southwest. And it's somewhat similar to coyote. If you look at the early biological survey of Texas that Vernon Bailey did and published in 1905, he did not have coyote east of around the Colorado Brazos River. And that means the coyote was not in the Piney Woods or east of in 1905. But as we've opened up the woods and made things more open, things like roadrunner and coyote have moved eastward. And so that's a human-created phenomenon. We're opening the woods. We're creating this this welcoming to birds that like more open instead of being in the shadows and the shade of tree canopy all the time. That is not what a roadrunner or a coyote necessarily like to do. Another thing we did is eradicated the red wolf, a different species from the coyote. And the red wolf probably played a significant role keeping, as an apex predator, keeping other competitors out. So it wasn't only just that we opened up the piney woods, but we also had another species of canid that kept the coyote well west of here. So I think the roadrunner is something you'll see from now on. They're low density. I'll see maybe two or three a year, and I drive around a lot in the piney woods, and sometimes I'll revisit sites. I don't find them again. I don't know where they go. I don't know what they do. We probably have some Christmas bird count data we could look at to see if there's any real trend. But the big trend would be that they were never here, and boom, now they are, and they're not really going to colonize in huge numbers. I don't think that we're going to have lots and lots of roadrunners. We're just going to have a scant few.
Yeah, that tells me a lot. I was very surprised to see it when it showed up.
Yep, and he's doing what roadrunners do. They really like eating reptiles, so snakes, lizards. They'll eat a lot of large grasshoppers as well. So roadrunners are good neighbors to have. If you don't like snakes around, a roadrunner is a good neighbor to have.
Okay, thank you.
Yep, okay, Robert.
All right, thank you, Robert. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. If you'd like to call us up with a question tonight, 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We go next to Titus from Marshall. Titus, what's your question tonight for Cliff?
Hello, how you all doing?
Doing good.
We're good.
Okay, when I lived in my old house, we had a tree outside our house, and round about, I guess about 12, 1 o'clock, it sounded like a mockingbird.
Mm-hmm.
It would just sing and sing and sing, and I'd be sleeping real good, and all of a sudden he'll wake me up, and I cannot go back to sleep.
Well, and you said sounded like a mockingbird, but it was a mockingbird. They are known to sing all through the night. Those are probably what we believe are single males. So lonely males looking for a girlfriend. So and 'cause we don't have a lot of mockingbirds sleeping singing all through the night. Another key feature is if you've got a security light, a bright light. They really like that, too. But I think that,
yeah,
that maybe you had a lonely male there, Titus, and he was trying to find a girlfriend.
Apparently he wanted some company, so he had some.
He did, and he woke you up, and I feel it, man. I don't like that kind of stuff. When I sleep, I've got to have it pretty quiet. And being a bird watcher, of course, if I had a mockingbird singing, I'm trying to identify what is he imitating. And so then I'm wide awake going, oh, there, he just did a red-bellied woodpecker. Oh, he went right into tufted titmouse. Now he's doing blue jay. And oh, wow, a Chuckwills widow. Or was that the real Chuckwills widow? No, it was him. And all of a sudden I'm wide awake and the party's over. So
that's it.
Yep.
That is it.
And Titus, I'm right there with you. I had one of these outside of my window in the spring for 3 years in a row.
Oh, wow.
I think he finally got a girlfriend because he was gone this year.
Yeah, well, we moved.
Yeah, hopefully not because of the mockingbird.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you
much. Thanks, Titus. Right.
Thank you, Titus. Right. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call now at 800-552-8502. We have lines open right now. That's 800-552-8502. We go next to Gail from Marshall, Texas. Gail, you're online with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
What kind of birds eat love bugs? And can we make more of them?
Yeah, that would be a very fat bird right now, wouldn't it? I've never seen the love bug problem like right now. And actually, if you've listened to the station, Beverly
talks about them. I knew that.
And she did a module on it, which is a small commercial explaining what's going on, because this is an unusual year for that one. But to answer your question, I don't know if there is a bird that's capitalizing on that. I don't see eastern. I don't see eastern phoebe or eastern kingbird or barn swallows coming in low to get these guys. I don't know why, but my goodness, they would be fat birds. Maybe they don't eat them because they'd eat so many and they wouldn't be able to fly anymore, huh?
Maybe so, but so we take a low flying bird, is what you're saying.
Yeah, maybe so. Yeah, because most of these bugs are pretty low, as we've seen, and boy, I wouldn't want where these guys are concentrating near roadways. I don't think I'd want to see a lot of birds feeding low in front of traffic.
No.
So it's probably a good thing.
Well, my car certainly feeds on them. Say that. Thanks to Dr. Burden. I know what to do about it.
Yes.
Yeah, wash them off immediately.
Yes.
Okay, well, thank you, and I really enjoy your program.
Oh, great. Thank you, Gail.
You are listening to Bird Calls with with Cliff Shackelford. I almost said Dr. Beverly Burton. And you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. Dr. Burton will be back in October, in case you're wondering, and she will be with us on October 17th, and she can explain all about the love bugs this year. Mostly it means we had a very wet spring and a cool summer, and it also means the waterways are actually healthy because that's how they proliferate. It's a good sign for the clarity and the non-pollution of the water. So,
and I like that bugs come up during our show, because guess what? Over half of our birds eat most of the time bugs. So insects are incredibly important to our birds. If we love birds, we need insects. So we need to maybe think about that before we start spraying away harsh chemicals on our insects. Let the birds do their job.
There you go. We're going to go next to Kim from Overland. Kim, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Hi, Cliff. I was wondering, every morning we hear these birds that sound as if they're saying pretty, pretty, pretty.
Pretty, pretty, pretty. You know, we talked about that a little while ago. Mary had a bird that said, wakes her up with, "We need you, we need you." And there's variation in the Carolina wren. I'm wondering if maybe you've got a Carolina wren just saying the same thing over and over, pretty, pretty, pretty. It could be that. Maybe take a recording and with your cell phone, and anybody can do that. You use the video function. Don't worry about pointing the image at the bird, but just grab the sound and then call us back with it. But I'm going to guess that it's like Mary's bird, it's a Carolina wren.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you.
Yep.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We have lines open now. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question concerning our avian world or maybe the insects that they like to eat? We'll try to help you out. Or the lizards and snakes and frogs. We're going to go to next to Sue from Nacogdoches, Texas. Sue, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Yes, I have feeders up all year. And during the summer, my flat feeders, I sometimes have to replenish them twice a day. But I notice that now the food is not being eaten as much, and the soot balls are not being used as much. Is the bird population changing at this point in time?
Yeah, I don't recommend feeding soot year-round. I mean, when it gets hot, it starts to ooze, and the ants sure love it. And the birds don't really need it this time of the year. There's plenty of food out there to eat, and that's what they're doing. They're going to save your little feeding station for maybe supplemental or when times are really tough, and that's not right now. So,
okay, but on the bird seed and everything like that, they like during the summer, they've been there a lot for the flat feeders where the bird seed and things are located. But now I notice that even on the flat feeders, there's not as much food being eaten.
Yeah, and that's, again, that cardinals are going to be probably year-round in your yard, and they're just probably, saying, I'm done with that fast food business. I'm going to eat Mother Nature's smorgasbord out here in the backyard. So
okay.
They're eating
the
other
birds
stuff.
Are not migrating at this time.
Well, they are. So some of your birds that you could have had eating at your feeder this summer have definitely migrated. But the big push of the seed eaters are coming. And we get the most use in the winter, the colder months, is when we get the big flocks of goldfinches and siskins and chipping sparrows and grackles and blackbirds and so forth. So feeding in the winter is a lot more productive.
Okay, and yep. Don't feed soot during the summer.
You can, but if you're telling me that they're not eating it, I wouldn't do it. There's plenty other food to eat. Because that's soot is kind of homemade caterpillars and soft fleshy insects. So they'd rather eat the real thing. But that stuff isn't available in the colder months like January and February. So that's when woodpeckers and wrens will come to the soot feeders because it's kind of like eating yummy, juicy caterpillars.
Okay.
Yep.
Well, I just wondered because I've been keeping everything that I feed out all year round, but I will not put the soot out next summer.
Yeah, and have you had a problem with ants coming up to the soot and getting in it when it's hot like this?
No, I haven't had any problem with the ants at all. Uh-huh. And the woodpeckers do come, and I see them, pecking away at it sometimes. And there's some other birds that do it. I have about 8 feeders up, and I have one right outside my window.
Oh, cool.
That I can sit and watch them a lot.
Yeah, and the woodpeckers are probably the coolest ones to come to the feeder to eat the soot. And I think that if you keep it up in the colder months, you'll be rewarded.
Okay.
Yep.
Listen, thank you so very
Great.
Much.
Thank you, Sue.
Bye-bye.
Now, would a watering stop be a better thing in the hot summer? A good watering bird bath,
right.
A place for them to get a fresh drink of water?
That's right. This year, not so much. We've had so much rain that there's been creeks full, puddles full, et cetera. But most summers, when it is dry, especially later in the summer, a bird bath is very important.
Yeah, those August months especially, when it gets up to 105, 110 heat index.
And people that run bird baths know to keep it, clean every few days, even if it has water in it, to refill it, to spray it out and refill it. Or if you've got big birds like blue jay or brown thrasher, they will splash the water out, because that's one thing you learn with a bird bath is birds don't only drink water, they bathe in water. And a lot of birds are very meticulous about bathing, and they have to. I mean, think about being able to fly. You've got to be in top condition, just like at an airport where you've got inspectors checking every little piece of that airplane. Birds are doing the same thing. We notice it when they're preening. They're fixing feathers, making sure they're in top shape, and then they're cleaning them when they take their bath. So that's pretty fun to do, is to run a bird bath. Yep.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We have lines open now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We go next to Richard from Bossier City. Richard, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Hey, sir. How you guys doing?
Hey, we're great. How's it going,
okay.
Richard?
Hey, listen. I got a question back to a caller who just called in about that pesky, the love bug. Love bug. I understood that the reason why other birds won't eat them is because they're acidic.
And that's a good question for Beverly on what's bugging you. That doesn't surprise me, because when you've got such a bloom of insects, you would expect birds to respond. For example, when you see termites emerge out of a stump, and it rained the night before and it's cool that next morning, there's a breeze, they start getting into a wing stage and start distributing. And that's when a lot of flycatching birds will just camp out at where termites are emerging. And you'll see even other birds, summer tanagers, and you'll see kingbirds, and just everybody is camping out because the termites are pretty darn tasty. But you're right, the love bug must be acidic. Something's got to be up. He don't taste too good.
If it hurts the paint job on cars,
yeah.
Then that's telling you that that's part of the reason why, those little other birds don't want to eat them.
Yeah, that's right.
Any bird that eats mosquitoes and pesky insects, like mosquitoes and flies. It was definitely a friend of mine.
Good, good.
I was just, that's what I understood. That bug is that love, that nasty love bug is acidic.
Yeah.
And that's why it damages, the paint job on cars. And that's the reason why other birds, they don't really care to eat them.
Yeah,
maybe Dr. Burton is listening and we can get her to call in and clarify. Ooh, oh, there you go.
That'd be fun.
Well, I thank you guys so much for answering.
Great. Thanks, Richard.
All right, y'all have a great day.
Thanks.
I just wonder about people who like hot peppers because those are kind of acidic too. And, we have a lot of those fans around. So, well, give us a call, folks, 800-552-8502. This is Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And lines are open, 800-552-8502. We go next to Brian from Marshall, Texas. Brian, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Well, I turned my radio down to make a phone call, and I caught the back end of Richard's question, and y'all pretty much just answered it for me. I was calling to see what birds was a natural predator of the love bug.
Yeah.
There's such a big epidemic right now. And, that was pretty much it.
Okay. Well, that was easy, Brian. So.
Yes, it was.
All right. Well, thanks for calling.
Well, and ask and ye shall receive. Dr. Burton is online now.
All right.
Dr. Beverly Burton, can you help us out? Why don't the birds eat the love bugs?
They are acidic, and that is probably why, but they also contain an alkaloid chemical that can be distasteful to the birds, just like the monarch butterflies are distasteful to birds. It's the same chemistry that's going on.
Wow.
Very cool. And I'm honored, Dr. Burton, that you're calling during the show. And obviously, we have a call in here. We needed a phone a friend, and we did, so to speak.
Because took a lifeline.
Because love bugs are dominating the episode right now. So we need you.
Well, and here I am.
And that's so great. And I've heard your module that you do that plays on the radio about the love bug. That's a great way to inform us all, and thank you for doing that.
Well, thank you for what you do, Cliff.
Great.
I'll hang up and let you have the rest of your show.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Burton, and we'll see you in October. We'll see you during the fun drive, I believe, so which is coming up. You can give us a call now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. If you'd like to get on with Cliff, we have lines open. And any question regarding our avian world or the avian etiquette of dining is a legitimate question and territory, so give us a call. We go next to Caleb from Alexandria. Caleb, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Yes, I was wondering about, is there anything I can do to attract red-winged blackbirds to our yard? We just kind of have a big open space, no trees or anything, but it's my fiance's favorite bird call.
Wow. Most people despise red-winged blackbirds when they come into their backyard because they're usually coming to hen scratch feeders where you've got millet and cracked corn, and the red wings will often dominate and eat everything up, and a lot of people don't like that because there's no room for their cute little chickadees and their sweet little cardinals. So I'm impressed that she's trying to attract red-winged blackbirds, but I gave you the answer. It's get some hen scratch with millet, with cracked corn. And then it's a seasonal thing. We don't get the big numbers until the colder months. So
yeah,
that's not going to be a hot summer thing to do. But if she likes hearing red-winged blackbirds, there are so many neat National Wildlife refuges along the coast that hopefully by next spring we'll be ready to go after Harvey. But places like Anahuac National Wildlife Refuge, not far from Winnie, Texas, you can drive around on what's called Shoveler Pond and hear kajillion red-winged blackbirds. And that's a neat place to go to see and hear red-winged blackbirds. So
you
can start planning your spring trip, I think. That's when I would go, April, May, June, somewhere in there. There should be lots of red wings singing up a storm down on those refuges. Wherever you have marsh habitat is where you have lots of red-winged blackbirds nesting.
Okay, great. Yeah, we'll take a trip.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. All right, thank you. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We're waiting for some phone lines to come in. But in the meantime, you said this is the beginning of the migratory season. So now we're getting the hummingbirds. What's going to be coming in a few weeks that we should be seeing?
And another bird that is slowing down because most of them have passed through is Mississippi kite. That one I think most people have seen. That's a small raptor with very pointy wings and darts around with open wings, makes flight look very easy. They have passed through right now. Yep, we're in the peak of ruby-throated hummingbird migration. Late September, early October is probably the peak for a lot of our passerines, things like orioles and warblers and vireos. A lot of those guys that were breeding far to our north, the timing is such that they'll come through our area during that period. Again, late September, early October. And so then, you know, we'll see a big push of broadwing hawks will be coming through. They're kind of going to be late in the fall season, but I think most birds are somewhat in place by mid-November. In other words, our migrants have all departed us and our winter birds have all arrived. And it's now time to enjoy winter birds. But until mid-November, there's a lot of things flying through our area. If you're near a wetland, you would have noticed a lot of teal coming through already. Even shorebirds, if you've got mudflat habitat, shorebird migration in our area starts around the July 4th weekend. It begins and then really accelerates into late July and early August, but you got to have mudflats to witness that.
Now, how about robins? Do they come down through this area?
Yep, and robins, which I was looking at a publication that uses data to determine or estimate population size. Robin is in the top three of most abundant birds in North America, in the U.S. and Canada. And most of our robins visit us in this listening area in the winter, and they're in flocks. And they really roam around, and a lot of people think, well, I haven't seen robins yet. And, well, just wait, because these big, massive flocks are going around looking for berries, and once those berries are gone, they have to keep roaming. So they're very nomadic in the winter time. So they're in big groups in the winter, and that's when we have robins. So that'll be a winter thing.
Well, that was always in the spring growing up in Ohio. We knew spring was over when we saw the robins come back and start nesting.
That's
so
right.
Didn't matter whether there was snow on the ground still. We just knew that spring was about over, because that would not happen until the robins came and nested.
And migration in spring, that brings up a good point, is it's easier to witness spring migration when you haven't seen a bird for months.
Right.
And boom, all of a sudden, like you said, in Ohio, you've got an American robin in the yard and you haven't seen one all winter. The opposite is difficult. Fall, it's very difficult to determine when birds are leaving and have left, because we've had, say, red-eyed vireo and prothonotary warbler all summer long, and it's very difficult. Song is not as prevalent in birds in the fall. They're not singing as much, in other words. And so it's really difficult to witness fall migration in the same way of, okay, well, we noticed when the first arrivals came in the spring. Well, let's see if we can find the first departures or the definite departures. And that's really difficult to do.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We have lines open right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question concerning our avian world is welcome and fair game. Please call us again, 800-552-8502. Gary from Diboll, Texas, you are on line with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
Thank you very much. Me and my wife, buzzards, is it true that when they're circling, she says that when they're circling, there's a something dead down there, but I told her that they get way up in the air and the air lifts them up, right?
Yeah, that's a thermal. So they're
and then they just sit there like a cat.
Yeah, they you know, in migration they're circling and they're getting, if you watch them, they're getting smaller and smaller because they're getting higher and higher, And then they get to a point where they start going the direction they want. This time the year would be south. So the circling does not always mean there's something dead underneath.
Yeah, that's what. Yeah. Okay, well,
so did you bet your wife money on this one, or are you going to win?
No. I mean, I've been watching them, you know, about all my life down here. She just asked to say that, and I just didn't think. And then I listened to the radio. And I said, that's a good question.
But you didn't bet or anything, like doing the dishes.
No.
The loser has to do dishes tonight.
No, I'll probably do them anyway. I'll bet her, then I call you back.
Oh, there you go.
I'll call you next week.
And I got your back, Gary. We'll make sure you win, right?
I hear you, man. I appreciate it.
Oh, thanks.
Unlike the Hollywood rendition, I guess, which always has them circling overhead. So give us a call, 800-552-8502. All lines are open right now. You have Cliff Shackelford online. And we're ready to take your questions right now about our avian world. And any questions concerning birds is fair game.
And you mentioned just now about the vultures circling in Hollywood. And it's so funny being a bird watcher. You watch these old movies and they'll show a vulture, what we call a buzzard, flying overhead. And then they'll dub in the sound of the red-tailed hawk that we played earlier.
Or red shoulder.
And so it's so funny to see a vulture, hear the red-tailed, and it's Hollywood thinking, no one's going to know. But, you know, there's 60 to 70 million bird watchers estimated in the U.S., and a lot of them do know, and it's just smart to get the bird sounds right. You'll watch these old movies. What was the one with Meryl Streep, Out of Africa?
Yeah.
You watch that one, and I haven't watched it in 20 years, but I think there's blue jays calling.
Probably.
And you know, just stuff like that. And then, the old Tarzan movies, he was in Africa, right? And they'd have Australian birds, the kookaburra, calling. So there's a lot of this.
I even heard pileated woodpeckers in some of those old Tarzan.
Oh, yeah, that's
until
right.
Until I heard it on this show, I was like, well, that sounds like a Tarzan movie sound effect.
And I think what Hollywood needs to do is, you know, I think there's an opening for a lot of jobs for bird people to go in and consult on these movies, make sure that the birds are correct, because otherwise they're going to hear about it.
I know this. We did a documentary on a little town in Florida called Apalachicola. And we had wildlife biologists working with us, so we made sure we had all the right names for all of the birds, and we gathered all the sound effects on site so we knew that they were real, you know, for that area.
That's right. And I work with our Texas Parks and Wildlife Video Department, and we're constantly making sure that the bird in the video that you're looking at on the screen matches the sound that they've dubbed in, or maybe they didn't dub in. Maybe there was a bird just out of the screen next to it calling, and we have to make sure that it all fits, because otherwise we will hear from people.
Absolutely. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We have time for another question or two. Give us a call at 800-552-8502. Karen from Colfax, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Yes, we had a couple of hummingbirds, and it's like they were attacking each other to get to the hummingbird feeder.
Uh-huh.
Is that north? Are they territorial? They don't want to share the feeder.
That's exactly right. So if you've ever watched hummingbirds, it's quite a show. It's, you know, that we have all these pay-per-view shows, like the one 2 weeks ago where the two boxers got in there, McGregor and Mayweather, and they fought and people paid for that. If you like that, Jiminy Christmas, turn off the TV and look outside and run a hummingbird feeder, because it's constant fighting and battling over a resource. So these birds are protecting what they think is theirs, and that's what you'll see at a hummingbird feeder or at a popular nectar-giving bush that hummingbirds frequent.
Do they ever hurt one another? Do they ever kill one another?
I've never seen it happen. I'm sure it does. I have seen injured hummingbirds. My wife and I were in New Mexico many years ago, 15 years ago or maybe more. And we stayed at a place with a lot of hummingbirds, and there was a broad-tailed male that had a damaged eye. And, of course, I couldn't ask, hey, what happened to you? But I'm guessing that another hummingbird's bill did the damage. But you could sneak up to him because his right eye didn't work at all. It was all bulging and caked over. It wasn't. It was dry. It wasn't infected. I think he was now learning to live with one eye, but you could sneak up on his right side, and until he turned his head way around to see if you were coming, he'd fly off. But I'm sure there are lots of injuries. There could be death, but you know there are other things that kill hummingbirds that shouldn't be killing hummingbirds. Number one thing is going to be your windows. Number two is going to be your backyard cats. So if we're worried about death in hummingbirds, we need to be careful where we put our hummingbirds in relation to windows, and we need to keep our cats inside.
And we're going to go next to another caller. We want to thank that caller for calling in. And we've got David, and we're going to get you in real quick. David, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Where are you calling from, David?
Hello, David? Okay, maybe I got William online. William, is this you?
You got William.
Okay, I got William. There we go. Jumped over.
Where are you from, William?
I'm from Commerce, Texas.
Okay.
I'm down in Nacogdoches right now.
Okay.
But I've got a pair of Mexican eagles. I think they're called Caracaras.
Yes, sir.
Up at Commerce.
Uh-huh.
How far north do they migrate?
Well, those are resident birds. They're in small numbers up in the old post-oak belt, up through Terrell and up into your area, and they're just in real small numbers. They get to about the Red River, and that's it. So those aren't really migratory birds. Those are resident birds in small numbers, and they've bred. They breed in that area. I mentioned this before, that I got my lifer, Caracara, in Terrell, Texas, when I was a kid. So they're up there, and that lifer was, you know, in the 70s sometime, long time ago. So they've been in your area for quite a while.
Okay.
Yep.
Well, first time I seen them was about 3 years ago, and it looks like it's just a pair of them.
Yeah, and they're in. Go ahead.
Well, I see them every summer. I don't see them that much in the winter, but okay.
Yeah, they're in small numbers, and so when you're just a few and small, low density, you're hard to detect, like we mentioned with the Roadrunner earlier. But Caracaras, you can find them at roadkill. They really like chicken farms before recommendations change on how you deal with the dead carcasses, because you could find them at the day when they harvested chickens at a chicken farm. You can find them at fish kills. They're much like vultures. They're going to take a free, easy meal of dead stuff. Yum, yum.
All right, and we want to thank you, William, for that call. And it is time for us to get to our conservation tip to end out this week's edition of Bird Calls. Cliff, what do you got for us this week?
So at the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, we get inquiries from the general public wondering what they can do about those messy barn swallow nests on their patio and the poop piles the birds leave behind. Well, those poop piles show that those birds are working for you. They're eating pesky insects on the wing. Without swallows and flycatchers and other insectivorous birds, we'd be overrun with insects. In the same way, no one likes the idea of rats and mice taking over their home or property. Did you know that an individual barn owl reportedly eats over 1,000 rats and mice per year, making them one of our most effective agricultural pest control agents and a good neighbor to have? But often our response is to put out poison if we're having a rodent problem. And poison bait ingested by a rodent that is later eaten by an owl or the red-tailed hawk, the species we profiled near the beginning of this episode, can often lead to the bird's demise. Instead, consider removal of nuisance rodents by good old trapping methods. Respect the role that raptors have in our environment. Without them, we'd be overrun with pesky insects and rodents. Allow birds to fulfill their role in nature. If they're nesting, they'll only be there for a short period of time. A little patience can go a long way. Consider that these birds are working for you, and they're working for free. A lot of respect for nature, plus an understanding of biological pest control, can go a long way. Do it for the birds.
All right. Thank you very much, Cliff. And you've been listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist. And he is with the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. He is their statewide non-game ornithologist. And we want to thank him again for joining us tonight, Cliff. And Bird Calls is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of Louisiana. The producers for this show are Bill Beckett and Cliff Shackelford. We had help tonight from Wally Derleth, Henry Edwards, and Tim Schnell. The audio for tonight's program will be posted on our website in the next few hours. And you can also listen to past programs again as well at that site. That's redriverradio.org. Just click on Bird Calls. Stay tuned. Radio Lab is next here on Red River Radio. And coming up on Tuesday, October 10th, we'll have the next edition of Bird Calls. This is Red River Radio, and we are your community-supported public broadcasting service from LSUS. We are KDAQ, Shreveport-Bossier City, KLSA Alexandria Pineville, KBSA El Dorado Magnolia, and KLDN Lufkin Nacogdoches.